Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 29th in the year 2000. This afternoon in our fireside room, we are pleased to have as our presenter, Cynthia Molibita, who is continuing her series on the effects of economic globalization. Today's presentation is entitled, Market Ideology as Theology. Who are we? Let's listen in.
I think it is time to begin, so the tapers can start rolling the tapes. I'm Cynthia Molibita, and this is the second of five sessions in which we will be looking at two realities that aren't usually held together. One of those is economic globalization in its prevailing form today, and the other is the faith claim that God lives in us and in all of creation, and living in us may empower us to live in ways that resist injustice and live into ways of love. So those are the two things that we'll be holding together throughout the week. This group is predominantly new people who haven't been at the previous session or any of the sessions last week, so let me take just a moment to situate today's inquiry in the context of this entire week. We will spend these five sessions looking at a fundamental contradiction that is haunting. And that contradiction is this: we are called and sent forth to proclaim the good news that God loves this world. We are called to be the body of Christ on earth. We are here on earth to receive the love of God, to live out that love of God, to love God and to love others and to love ourselves. This is our reason for being. It's why we're here. I would dare say that all of us long to live according to that call to love neighbor as self and to love our God. And yet somehow, in stark contrast, in tragic contrast, we live according to economic arrangements that destroy many people on earth, and that are undermining earth's very capacity to sustain life. Economic arrangements that are depleting the earth's capacity to continue sustaining life as we know it. Economic arrangements that create an enormous gap between the rich and the poor. These are distinctly non-loving ways of being. They are economic arrangements that provide us with the capacity to consume far more than we need, and a few people the capacity to accumulate tremendous, tremendous wealth on this earth. So we are perhaps in bondage to, acquiescent to, complicit with economic arrangements that defy our call to love neighbor as self and to care for the earth. It's that contradiction that I put before us and ask us to grapple with according to a certain sequence of questions and probings that we'll do together. I understand very well that my claim or my assertion that the economic ways by which we live are deadly is a very grating, a very strident, a very out there kind of a claim to make. And we can't in these sessions provide all the data and the arguments to substantiate that. So rather than doing so, I'm using a few voices, predominantly voices from third world or two-thirds world countries. We read a few voices yesterday, and again, these are voices that substantiate my claim, or rather, yeah, my claim that our economic ways are damaging the poor and damaging the earth, to say the least. I'd like to share a couple of other voices today and to re-articulate one of the voices that we heard yesterday. By way of setting the stage for what we intend to do today and in the next three sessions together. The first voice I read, and this is a very these are very short readings. Excuse me just a moment. The first voice is from a report created annually by the United Nations Human Development Program. It's the Human Development Report for 1998. And this is what it says. Three-fifths of people in developing countries have no access to basic sanitation. Almost one-third are without safe drinking water. Installation of water and sanitation for all would cost $9 billion. $11 billion is spent annually on ice cream in Europe. $8 billion is spent annually for cosmetics in the United States alone. Basic health care and nutrition would cost $13 billion. $17 billion a year is spent on pet food in Europe and the United States. It's a kind of statement. There are myriads of statements similar to this, but it's one to symbolize the contradiction that I'm trying to hold up for us. Hear then another voice, and this is by Martin Kaur, an economist from Malaysia, I believe. He writes, "Via their domination of the new global systems of trade and finance, the industrial countries have rapidly sucked out forest, mineral, and metal resources from the third world and used its land and labor. The industrial nations, approximately one-fifth of the world's population, use up four-fifths of the world's resources, mostly for luxury products. Only a small portion of the world's resources serves the basic needs of the poor majority in the third world, who sink deeper into the trough of poverty and destitution. The very process of extracting third world resources results in environmental disasters such as massive soil erosion and desertification, pollution of water supplies, and poisonings from toxic substances. This is the ultimate environmental and social tragedy of our age." And finally, one other voice. And this is a voice from the State of the World report, which is written annually by the World Watch Institute. It's a report that's used broadly used throughout the world by people involved in development work and and environmental work. This report says, "Biodiversity is the basis of our existence. However, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, humanity now finds itself in the midst of a mass extinction. A global evolutionary convulsion with few parallels in the entire history of life. Most estimates are that at least 1,000 species are lost per year. But unlike the dinosaurs, we are not simply the contemporaries of a mass extinction, we are the reason for it. Reversing this trend calls for a restructuring of the global economy. It calls for replacing our consumer culture with a less materialistic and far more environmentally literate way of life. The fate of our children depends upon it in ways we can barely begin to conceive." To take those voices seriously and to understand that we are part of that consumer culture is, and we talked about this yesterday, it's a grand reason to despair and give up or run away. And I have spent years, in fact, on the brinks of those despairs and those runnings away. And so I think we need to acknowledge that we can feel hopeless. As some people have said to me, friends of mine, I feel muted, I feel dwarfed, I feel unable even to look at these realities. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge that it is painful and that to face these things directly, to say, I will hear these voices and I will learn ways to live differently, learn ways to embody love, to resist this kind of economic life, and to create alternatives, to forge paths that humanity has never before forged, is an act of tremendous courage. One man said yesterday that he woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and was being gnawed by this contradiction, and I thought being gnawed is a wonderful thing, and it's a courageous heart that can be gnawed by realities such as this. So I do assure you that my intention for these days is not to wallow in the pits of despair or guilt about our complicity, but to face it and to find our way towards alternatives, grounded in the fact that God lives in us. That's pretty much to say what we're doing. That's a bit of a review for those of you who were here yesterday. Yesterday, what we did was really take a look at the first of many important questions. And that question is, as I say it, what is going on here? What are the power dynamics and the basic trends entailed in economic globalization? We need to become literate. We need to be able to discern what's going on, and it's a task that we are all capable of. It's not a tough task to begin to read and decipher and demystify what's going on in the global economy. It's incumbent upon all of us, and that's what we began to do yesterday. Today, we dig into another of two questions that I perceive to be crucial if we are to forge paths towards economic justice and environmental sustainability. And I've written these two questions up here for us to take a look at. The first is this, and the first is the question that we'll look at today. The second is the question we'll look at for the remaining days. Number one, if the prevailing model of globalization brutalizes the poor and jeopardizes Earth's regenerative capacities, why do we acquiesce to that model without declaring it a grand affront to our faith in Jesus Christ? Why do we not stand up and say, no, I refuse? Secondly, where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral, spiritual power to resist, to revision, and to rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the entire Earth community according to justice and compassion for generations to come? So these are the two questions. Why do we comply, and where is our power to resist and to rebuild in alternative ways? So that sets a stage. Let's look at the first of these questions. I would suggest, and I'm sure we all are aware, that there are many, many dynamics of many kinds that go into our acquiescence in the face of global economic injustice. I would suggest today that we look at one of those dynamics, or maybe one set of those dynamics. Hear the words of Francis Moore LePay. Is that a familiar name? The author of Food First, Diet for a Small Planet? She did some of the early work in economic justice and hunger issues. She writes, "What could be powerful enough to allow us to tolerate, to accept, to acquiesce to millions of silent deaths by hunger every year? What could possibly explain our ability to condone such a status quo? I finally have come to believe that there is only one thing powerful enough. It is the power of ideas. The ideas we hold about ourselves and our relationships to one another. It is these ideas that allow us to condone or even to support with tax dollars that which we as individuals abhor and somehow to tolerate the discomforting contrast." I refer to these sets of ideas as an ideology. And the word ideology has many connotations. I refer to it to mean a worldview, a way of organizing how we perceive the world and what is possible and what is not possible. An ideology shapes the questions we ask, the questions we refuse to ask. An ideology shapes who we believe we are and who we are in relationship to others, in relationship to God, in relationship to creation. An ideology not only tells us what to believe, it tells us what to ignore, what to not see. In other words, the ideology that I am going to suggest runs our life is free market ideology. And by erasing, I mean this, for instance. Free market ideology enables us to believe that we can eat strawberries in season or out at low cost, at cost to no one. When in reality, those strawberries may be growing on land that ought be growing corn and beans and rice for babies, for little kids who are dying because they're not getting the food that the land ought grow. They are erased by our belief that we can have food from all over the world at any time of the year at very low cost. We erase the people that suffer for that reason. I'm convinced that there is a powerful set of ideas that work together, which I call free market ideology. It's a worldview that distracts us from knowing who we are, deceives us about who we are and what our freedom is, and particularly deceives us and distracts us from knowing the power that resides in us by virtue of being the body of Christ on earth, by virtue of being the bearers of the Holy Spirit. Where we do not see clearly the ideologies that shape us, they continue to shape us and our children. The task before us is to dig in and uncover and scrutinize and assess, hold up for public scrutiny, the ideas and belief systems that run us. I would suggest that there are a number of fundamental components of free market ideology. I hold up for you four of them, and we'll look at two today. We looked at another of them last week. These are four of what I term market myths. And the first of the market myths is this: deregulated, that is free, trade and investment generates growth that trickles down to benefit everyone. The code word for the current globalizing economy is free. Trade and investment across international borders, the movement of goods and services and capital across international borders, needs to be freed from any kind of interference by governments at any levels. And that is the first of our big market myths, is that freedom necessarily creates growth that benefits everyone. As we discussed last week, that's a two-clause myth. The first clause is that free trade and investment generates growth, which is very true. Economies grow. The second clause is that growth trickles down to benefit all, and that is incredibly faulty and filled with holes and misconceptions. But that's the first of the market myths. The second is what I call a moral anthropology, meaning who we are as moral beings, a doctrine of the human, beliefs about who we are that are consistent with free market ideology. And if we get time, we'll get to that myth today. The third is a set of presuppositions about freedom, linking human freedom to market freedom. And that's the one with which we'll begin as we go into these today. And the fourth myth is that corporate and finance-driven globalization, which is a code word to describe the dominant model of economic globalization today, is inevitable. It's somehow ordained by God. It's the way things ought to be. It's, quote-unquote, the end of history. History has been progressing towards democratic capitalism as we know it, in which the global market determines life to a large extent, and that this is sort of the way history has been progressing. And I think that myth has been reinforced by the fall of the Soviet bloc and our assumption that there are only two alternatives in the world, the Soviet bloc's way and the current way, and that there's nothing else. So those are the four myths that I throw out for your consideration. One of those we'll begin with, and that is the set of presuppositions about freedom. Parenthetically, just keep in mind that tonight we have a forum that will be looking at some things related to that, so there will be more time for discussion and probing around this set of myths tonight. Why do we label markets free? What the word free means is deregulated, is unconstrained by government rules, regulations, by political, by public considerations other than market. But we call this free. Labeling deregulated commerce as free, that is, with the terminology of unalienable moral rights, associates it with freedom of the human spirit. Moral freedom, political freedom, and democracy. To call free markets free somehow makes a rhetorical link with democracy. I would suggest there are a number of components of this association between market freedom and human freedom. And there are many. Let me read for you two or three that I think are very pithy, very key. One is this. And what I should say is that the association between market freedom and human freedom is not something I'm making up. It's not an interpretation. It's very explicit in the language of the many bodies of people, the many sectors arguing in favor of deregulated trade and investment. The International Chamber of Commerce, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is the organization of the 29 industrial nations, academic economists in support of this system of globalization explicitly make this link. The far right, the religious right. So I read to you a couple of their voices. This is from the International Chamber of Commerce. Deregulation and improvement of market access fosters competitiveness and prosperity as the most reliable basis for freedom and dignity. Here are voices from the religious right. Civil and religious freedom, progress, and the preservation of human rights are inextricably linked with economic freedom and with a minimum of state interference in economic affairs. The OECD says, the case for open markets, open is another word for deregulated or free, is based upon the human desire the world over for more rather than less freedom. I think there are a set of presuppositions inherent in that kind of language. And I'll name for you a few of them. One is this. The human species is free to use the Earth's resources for the sake of profit. That freedom extends only to those humans who have the who can buy, who can pay for Earth's resources. Secondly, free markets, that is free trade and investment, and the freedom of choice in buying things enhances human freedom and is in fact a necessary condition for human freedom to flourish. To obstruct the freedom of the markets is to obstruct human freedom. And finally, freedom is threatened. Oh, third, market freedom as seen in capitalism is a necessary condition for democratic freedom rather than a threat to democratic freedom. Now, those are just implicit assumptions in our assumption as a society that the freer the markets are, the freer we are as human beings. The problem with this claim is that it leads us to believe that we are enhancing freedom for people the world over, when in fact we might be detracting from or blocking, inhibiting the freedom of people the world over. And I'd like to share some possibilities, some examples of that with you. But first of all, do you have thoughts or reflections yourself on those presuppositions, those notions of freedom that are inherent in our use of free to describe market activity? Or any reactions to the voices that I just read? Frank.
Yeah. I was gonna say what's going on down in Los Angeles right now with the regulation of the power industry down there. Mm. They're having a hard time right now. They've deregulated the power and people are suffering because the companies are making lots of money. Our power companies up here are probably not giving all the power to us. They're sending it down there where they can make more money.
I see.
So I see that going on right in this country right now, not just outside this country.
Okay, that's an excellent example. And we might, those of us who lean towards deregulation automatically might think that that's a positive move for people, but you're pointing out that it creates great problems for people.
People are suffering because they're not getting enough electricity.
Okay. And Frank, I also appreciate the fact that I've been orienting this discussion a little bit in the international arena, but it's very, very pertinent to life here in the United States at this time also. Absolutely. Any other examples where you can see? Sue?
Well, I was just wondering about our relationship with Microsoft mm-hmm. and how it has been brought to court and brought to question.
Mm-hmm.
And their claim to do whatever they want and us trying to figure out exactly mm-hmm. they have a right to do that
mm-hmm.
and who it hurts.
Mm-hmm. And that raises a good point, us meaning the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're raising the fact that this is an example where there is a public claim to have some say in determining whether or not the freedom of Microsoft to operate as it wishes to is good or is not good for the broader public.
Well, I think it's being questioned,
mm-hmm.
which is
exactly
kind of amazing.
Which is kind of amazing. Yes, maybe so. Good point. Yes.
Often I think of the term free and sometimes throwing in democracy and other things. It seems to me that when we put it in freedom in an economic role,
mm-hmm.
we talk about the freedom for us, whoever us is mm-hmm. at the top of the heap at that point, or whoever mm-hmm. wants to make the most that they can
mm-hmm.
to take care of themselves. You know, the United States primarily mm-hmm. was built on that rugged individualism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't do a lot with society. So I have the economic freedom to go as high as I can.
Mm-hmm.
If I am a corporation
mm-hmm.
and I can drag a few of my friends with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the responsibility to look at others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I choose not to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just how inclusive is that I or my group or whatever going to be, and whom do I choose to leave out or
mm-hmm.
just sort of ignore? So.
Your point is a very good one, that it's been inherent in our notion of freedom in the United States, that I can do, well, what I will with my property to advance myself economically, regardless of the implications. I think perhaps one way in which that has been very subtle but very powerful is the freedom to operate as I will without taking into consideration the environmental impacts. What would happen if large global corporations actually had to pay for the environmental cleanup and the long-term environmental impact? But freedom as we know it does not include. Freedom is the freedom to operate without taking that. Those costs are externalized, as we say in economic language. Any other thoughts? Just anyone else who hasn't commented? John?
A couple of thoughts. One, I guess some 10 years ago, we participated in this NAFTA.
Yes.
Maybe you could give some reflection on how that's working.
Sure.
And then this World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. They have meetings and there's so many protesters and whatnot, and I have a hard time understanding what's going on there totally, and,
mm-hmm.
and whether the protesters are, you know, very intentional people or
mm-hmm.
Rebel troublemakers, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, what is that crowd? So
mm-hmm.
I'm confused about both those issues.
Right, NAFTA and the WTO.
Yeah.
Well, your question is really right on target, because both of those issues are precisely issues of promoting NAFTA and WTO, promoting free trade and investment, and those opposing NAFTA and the WTO questioning it. It would take many sessions to go into it at length. Many people, NAFTA, I'm not sure everyone is familiar, John brought up NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was signed some years ago between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. NAFTA pertains mostly to trade in freeing, deregulating trade in goods and services across international borders, but it does have an investment clause that also frees investment, speculative and other, across international borders. So it's a powerful treaty. There is another multilateral treaty that has been negotiated and is now on hold worldwide that would be like NAFTA but extend throughout the globe and involve much more investment-related work, not just trade. It's called the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. NAFTA was kind of an early of many multinational, multilateral treaties looking at this. Many people thought that NAFTA would be tremendously helpful to the economies of the three nations, Mexico, U.S., and Canada, and now many, many people are appalled by the impacts of NAFTA. What I would hold up, and I think that, John, the WTO also, of course, in the protests, there were many kinds of people, many, many, many. There were many very sincere, I mean, there were people out there just to wreak havoc, we all know that. There were also very sophisticated, sincere people from around the world, many of them representing groups that are struggling towards economic alternatives, who are protesting precisely what we're talking about here, the power of large economic entities, that is, global corporations and finance institutions, to make public policy decisions. The protests pertained to many, many dimensions of the WTO, but one is precisely this that we're talking about now, the freedom of huge economic powers to determine public policy. And that, as I said yesterday, 51 of the largest economies on Earth, 51 of the 100 largest economies on Earth now are corporations, meaning totally unaccountable to public input, public management, public accountability, making decisions that shape life as we know it. And I think that the one precise or concrete example I'll hold up concerning both WTO and NAFTA, related to what we're talking about here today, is that one clause in NAFTA and in the WTO enables corporations to sue governments, local, state, or federal, for actions that minimize profit. So, NAFTA, or rather Exxon, sued Canada for many, many millions of dollars because Canada prohibited the transport of a chemical, a substance produced by Exxon that is toxic. Exxon produces a toxic substance. It's banned in California and other places. Canada bans its export and is sued by Exxon, precisely based on NAFTA. Exxon wins $253 million from Canada. Now, what are the implications for the environment of that whole possibility being opened up? Maybe I'll stop there. That's just an example of the way this plays into those demonstrations and those concerns about WTO and NAFTA. And let's put that as a red flag for further discussion as the hour goes on. There was another person who raised a hand. Paul, and then Mark.
I have a brother who makes the point that every American becomes a socialist as soon as the price of gasoline goes up. Well, welcome to the free economy. I mean.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the government do something about it?
Oh, I see. I see. Regulate gas
regulate,
prices.
Regulate, yeah, sure, regulate.
Right, interesting. Good point. Yeah. Yeah. Mark.
I was just going to mention part of that WTO, because it was close to my backyard, was that also the NGOs had no ability to actually be able to have a voice in both in the WTO and the NAFTA agreements that were going on.
Okay, and by NGOs you mean non-governmental organizations, the non-profit organizations worldwide, and that was a part of the protest. Well, I would like to suggest, oh yes.
You know, the point you're also making is mm-hmm. is that a lot of our attitude about free trade is mm-hmm. based upon the freedom that we have as human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what you're talking about? That the perceived freedom that we have mm-hmm. inherent mm-hmm. in our humanity, mm-hmm. that we are free mm-hmm. to
what we want,
well pleased to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a scary premise.
Mm-hmm. Meaning, what do you mean by that? That we're free to do what we will is a scary premise. Yes.
It is a scary premise. Yes.
What are you saying by that?
Because that's how things become rampant. But if that's an ideology uh-huh. that we have about our humanity and who we are as human uh-huh. beings, then of course we can trade however we want freely.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to lose, you know, in the practicalities of how this is being played out, NAFTA and WTO and MAI and others, that it's all premised on this attitude
mm-hmm.
that we start with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because I think it's rooted in that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's where we need to challenge ourselves and our cosmos.
So challenge our actual understanding of what freedom means.
What freedom means.
And that is done, I think that's very true, and that's actually what we're trying to do right here, and it's done on many levels. Last week we had a Bible study, Michael led a Bible study, and one of the sections was looking at Galatians and Paul's understanding in the of freedom as very different from our common understanding of freedom and of free will. So we can challenge that notion biblically. We can challenge it with common sense. Freedom in trade and investment means deregulation. Well, what are regulations anyway? We think they're a bad thing in the general lingo, but they're also the thing that abolished child labor. They're the thing that enables us not to have poisons put in our foods. Regulations are part of what protects human beings from the from possibilities of tremendous exploitation.
It was your reading of, was it the right?
The religious right,
religious
yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
That really brings that to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget, you know, what, 25 years ago, visiting Forest Lawn Cemetery in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and going through this building
mm-hmm.
That depicted all kinds of scenes of our American Revolution for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside, as I came back outside to the side of this building, there was this huge 10-foot
mm.
cement statue of Jesus Christ, arms outstretched, but mm-hmm. not on a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And the inscription at the bottom saying, "In Christ we have been set free."
Mm-hmm.
Or that quote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how we then support our market ideology
mm-hmm.
from our understanding of scriptural mm-hmm. freedom, mm-hmm. I think is even mm-hmm. more scary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good point. Then, again, that warrants digging into notions of freedom, biblical notions of freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It also warrants digging into notions of freedom in our country, in America. From the founding days, there have been conflicting notions of freedom. Democratic theory and liberal theory, the theory of liberalism, pretty much promoted the individual's freedom to do anything. Democratic theory promoted the importance of the public putting setting parameters on individual freedom for the well-being of the common good. And the two have been in tension forever in the United States. It happens that one is winning out right now. So those would be, if we wanted to, as we, in the years that go on, pursue this, forge paths towards alternatives, we must be aware of what we mean when we say free. When we say free trade and investment, free markets, what does that mean? I'd like to hold up for you a few examples, poignant examples of people whose capacity to, whose freedom to survive is inhibited rather than enhanced by market freedom. To further my point that we ought be suspicious of this stampede towards a free global economy. Consider the small subsistence farmer in India. When the WTO agreement, back to the WTO, John, on, well, let me first say, we're talking about trade-related intellectual properties, one clause in the WTO. Trade-related intellectual properties basically are a set of regulations, that allow corporations and other entities to patent life forms, to copyright life forms, so that the sale of those life forms ensues in profit for the holder of the copyright. In other words, if I copyright a seed, or patent a seed, rather, when that seed is sold, I get a portion of the profit. So when this agreement, it's called the TRIPS Agreement, is fully enacted in India in 2005, which is the year it will be fully enacted, global corporations will have the right to patent seeds developed by Indian farmers' ancestors over generations and generations and generations. Under this agreement, subsistence farmers in India, and many in India are subsistence farmers, and other nations already threatened by hunger, it will be illegal for them to save seed from one year to the next. Rather, they must pay annual fees to use a particular type of seed. According to the United Nations, one likely use of this agreement is to create seeds that will germinate only when used with agrochemicals sold by the company that sells the seed. In other words, to be sure that the Indian farmers, this is to ensure the monopoly over the use of this seed. This will endanger, according to the UN, I quote, the 1.4 billion rural people who rely on farm-saved seed. Think about this. Here's a quote from an international leader, or from a leader in the International Seed Trade Federation, which has been highly influential in promoting this aspect of free trade and investment. He says, even though it has been a tradition in most countries that a farmer can save seed from his crop, it is, under the changing circumstances, not equitable that farmers can use this seed without paying a royalty. Now, you understand what it means to not be able to save your seed and have to buy it. It means death for farmers who have for generations depended upon that seed. There is a coalition of prominent Indian civil society groups who claim that this agreement, quote-unquote, pirates the intellectual property of farmers, healers, tribal people, and fisherfolk of India and other countries. Vandana Shiva, a physicist and an ecologist from India, calls this biopiracy. Advocates of this agreement refer to it as market freedom, their freedom to patent the seeds. A second example, what is happening to the freedom of this person? The United States, and here we're to NAFTA that was raised earlier by someone. Consider the United States worker who spent her working life at a good job in a GE aircraft engines plant that is to be closed and moved to Mexico as a result of the free trade inscribed by NAFTA. Countless jobs have been lost in similar plant closings. Lives and communities have been devastated. The president of one local union reports this. Contrary to the musings of John Reich and others that the primary loss of jobs in the United States through NAFTA and free trade would be unskilled work, both GE and other aircraft engine the work of GE and other aircraft engines are headed for Mexico, Russia, China, Brazil, and other countries. Company documents leaked show that GE Aircraft Engines is not only in a two-year all-out push to ship work overseas, but is demanding that their vendors do the same. At a meeting in Mexico earlier this year, GE told assembly vendors, the companies they buy from, that they would move to Mexico or get off from all GE business. He quotes the CEO of GE, John Welsh, saying this, ideally you would have every plant on a barge. What that means is that you could move your plant to wherever the labor is cheapest. So you could move it to Ireland for 5 years, and Ireland wants you, and the labor is cheap, and make a lot of money in Ireland, but as soon as labor rights start to go into play in Ireland and people are demanding more, or maybe environmental rules are kicking in Ireland, zap, you could take your barge and pop it over to someplace in Indochina and hire people real, real, real cheap and destroy the environment there and then head it to the free trade zone in Mexico. So this is, I'm trying to share with you, some of the implications of our, again, stampede towards free trade and investment. Here, just one more. I worked this summer with a group of international people on a World Council of Churches project, and one of the women was a Caribbean woman from Grenada, a former Catholic sister, who talked about the banana industry in Grenada, in the Caribbean islands, as being very different from the banana industry in Central America. The Central American bananas are owned by global fruit corporations who many of you probably know have, most of the companies, a very bad history of labor rights in Central America, including helping to overthrow the government, the democratically elected government of Guatemala. So these are the banana companies in Central America. On the other hand, the Caribbean banana companies farms are owned by small, very low-level farmers. Joe Blow in the Caribbean, owning and sustaining a life by growing and selling bananas. England has a long-standing preference, laws that prefer, make it easier to get bananas. They subsidize or have various quotas or whatever, but they have a preference for Caribbean bananas. And that has been extremely significant in enabling the Caribbean banana growers to survive. And it's a system of self-reliance and a self-respecting kind of agricultural industry in the Caribbean. Now, under the WTO, the U.S. based fruit companies that sell that produce bananas in Central America challenged England's preferential option for Caribbean bananas, saying it was illegal according to the WTO. Now I'm hearing this from the Grenadian woman, and I later learned about it in all the press. What it means if England stops preferring Caribbean bananas is that many of those farmers in the Caribbean will go under. They will know what happens when farmers in the Caribbean go under. Their kids get tremendously malnourished, they immigrate to the United States, all kinds of things happen if for generations you've grown bananas and no longer do you. So the U.S. fruit companies challenge England. England stops preferring Caribbean bananas. These farmers go under, and it's for the sake of the U.S.-based banana companies selling more of their bananas from Central America. Did you follow that? Mm-hmm. Now, it seems complex, it seems nasty, it seems out of our world, but it's a fundamental fact of public life today. That is the way the global economy is going, and it's something we have to know about. Now, it's delightful also to know that people all over the world are forming coalitions, organizations, people at all level, major scientists, physicians, public figures, farmers, saying this is not the way we want the global economy to go. Those are some of the people saying no to the WTO. So I want to hold up this dynamic for you, but also hold up the fact that people are organizing against it. The woman that I told you about, the Grenadian woman, was just a powerful woman organizing in her country against this kind of agreement.
Did you intentionally leave out the church?
Oh, the church. No, I didn't intentionally leave out, because the church is definitely involved in many levels in challenging this form of globalization. Yeah. The Lutheran World Federation is at this very moment designing a international study on economic globalization that will help Lutherans throughout the world to think about the implications of this for us as followers of Jesus Christ. I was part of a group of five people who met in Geneva this summer to begin thinking about how to design that study. The World Council of Churches is active. Churches on various levels. I'll mention again someone who was here last year that I don't think most of you heard me mention because it was last week. A Lutheran pastor, an older man, a retired man in South Dakota. And I was talking about all these international things, and he brought up the South Dakota farmers. And he brought up the fact that the South Dakota farmers are going under, like the Caribbean banana workers, because the grain companies, there used to be many, many, many grain companies that buy their grains. Now there are just a few, Cargill and Monsanto, the same ones that are working to patent the Indian seeds. But they can buy their soybeans and their corn at cheap, 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 cheap rates because they're so big and they have free market access, and the South Dakota farmers go under because they can't sell their seeds. And I said to this man, I had read the quote by Francis Moore LePay about silent deaths, and I had written that up there.
How do we tolerate the many silent deaths? And I said to this man, this Lutheran pastor, I said, what happens to the South Dakota farmers when Cargill buys their seeds so cheap and they go under? And he didn't say a word, not a single word. He just walked up to the board and he underlined the word silent deaths like this. But so this, that buying and selling of those seeds at cheap rates, the soybeans, not the seeds, the grains, is market freedom. But what is the freedom that it gives to the South Dakota farmers? We need to think about that. Yes, ma'am.
It isn't just the price of their seeds or the price of their equipment.
Yes.
They are down to maybe post-World War II price on grains and they're harvesting crops. Mm-hmm. And I think the farmers in Idaho, they're mostly grain farmers. A combine will cost $200,000 now, where it used to be below $10,000. Mm. And here they are selling crops in the 40s prices. They can't make it. It costs so much per acre to make it on a field. Mm-hmm. And then these prices are just making it more dead. Mm-hmm. Another thing I'm watching is Portland General Electric, local power of the Northwest, generated in the Northwest. Texas bought it about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Scotland bought it this year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. So what is that going to mean about power in the Northwest?
What is our power in the Northwest going to do in Scotland? Because my question is getting into a global situation now.
And free trade and investment says that they should have every right to buy that power.
We've just received notice, local news, that our power bills will probably go up 13% in January now.
Sue.
Well, we all do this at our own level. I mean, instead of supporting the small businesses in our neighborhoods, we'll go miles to go to Barnes & Noble instead of the little bookstore across the street, or major drug pharmaceutical kind of place where that you can buy your medicines for as cheap a amount as you can. Your local pharmacies don't get your business because it's more expensive to be a smaller business. Or to a different gas station every time that you think you can get the cheapest tire someplace. And I just think it's so horrid to be so stingy and so crappy with your neighbor who's trying to make a business and make a living doing a small business. And forever going out looking for the cheapest. I'm scared to ride on an airplane like at the cheapest price. Holy cow, you know, maybe the thing will stick in the air. But I don't like that. I don't like it if it happens in myself, and I don't like it if it happens around me.
Well, Sue, you could almost be planted there, that's such a pertinent comment. And we do tend to do that. And you hear people, I mean, all over the place, someone says, well, what a nice new dress that is. And they say, oh, I got it for just $12. Mm-hmm. As though that's a virtue, when really, you may have gotten it for $12 because it was produced in Guatemala, where someone was paid so dirt cheap that their kids are eating clay outside. So that's a good point. But the point I'd like to draw out of what you said, is this. We're not going to have time to look at this moral anthropology beliefs about who we are, but I want to say one statement about it based upon what you said, Sue. Neoclassical economic theory, the theory undergirding economic globalization today, assumes that we are a particular somebody, that human beings are homo economicos, economic man. We make our decisions based upon getting the most for our money. That is a motivating drive of being a human being. We'll buy cheapest, we will make decisions on those grounds. That's in very simple terms, that's a fundamental characteristic of who we are, according to the economic theory that underwrites all of this. Now,
there's a certain extent to which it is who we are. I mean, look at the way all of us behave that way. But is it really who we are? Or is it who we in our culture have been trained to be? And that understanding of who we are is spread throughout the globe. Is it really who we are? There are many other definitions of who we are. We can see ourselves as somebody else, someone here too, in our way of living, serve our own needs, and serve the well-being of the neighbor who might be the local bookstore owner, as you said, or the local someone else other than Costco. So I think we need to think about who we are. Am I economic man or economic woman, as we would say in not today, or am I a bearer, a lover who loves with the love of Jesus Christ, who is going to decide not to buy shoes made by a corporation or not buy electronics from a corporation that is polluting the land in the Rio Grande. So I guess I want to say, Sue, that you're right. We make these decisions based upon a certain notion of who we are, or a certain notion of who we are undergirds these, but we can decide we're not that, and we can turn to our faith to find out who we really are. Good comment.
The idea that there's not wrong to go to Costco either under certain conditions.
Yes. Yeah.
What if you wanted to host the whole two or three churches,
right,
or something,
right,
like that, and have a potluck,
right,
and you wanted to have a meal for everyone, and you couldn't afford to do it under some conditions? Maybe there were different kinds of ways you could probably,
yeah,
have that dinner.
Yeah.
But one way could be go to Costco and get a,
yeah,
bunch of food together.
But your real point was, we don't need to necessarily go for the cheapest if it's,
right,
made under exploitative circumstances.
Exactly.
We can decide to buy things that are produced in ways that serve the environment and serve the well-being of poorer people.
It's not always honorable to buy the cheapest.
Yeah. Yes.
That brings me back to the freedom thing too. One assumption of being free is that you can do whatever you want, but we're doing whatever we want without thinking about how connected we are with the rest of the world,
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm,
and how really dependent we are on the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So really not free.
That's a very good point, and that's another notion, a sense of who we are. We assume, under this economic theory tells us we're autonomous individuals, that who we are is essentially individuals. Now, another notion of who we are might be vastly different. Maybe we are organically connected creatures in a web of life, and that as opposed to being autonomous individuals or even a species set apart from the web of life, we are all intimately connected to it, and whatever we do is going to affect that web of life. We're accountable to the vast economy of life, not just to the well-being of the individual. So it brings up another way for us to think about, who are we? This autonomous individual or this integral part of the web of life? Yes.
Looking at that, I think it was Sue was talking about what we buy. You know, I'm one of those that buys for the cheapest, you know,
mm-hmm,
like everybody else. And I invest for the highest, too. You know, I'm one of those people that,
mm-hmm,
that doesn't have a pension, whatever, so I have to look. And sometimes I want the best return on my money, thank,
mm-hmm,
you. You know, because I'm going to be old someday,
mm-hmm,
and nursing homes are expensive. And to me, sitting in here, this is exactly the same struggle, if you will, that these corporations are going through, or I hope they are.
Mm.
I'm struggling with, you know, sell high, you,
mm-hmm,
know, buy low,
mm-hmm,
and this personal risk. So what I find is, if I can find this struggle in me,
mm-hmm,
and what am I going to do it on a personal level?
Mm-hmm.
I am not different than that corporation.
Mm-hmm.
I am as greedy,
mm-hmm,
on my level.
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to solve this as a person to help them understand how to solve it as a corporation? That's my struggle, and it has been my struggle. How will I help them? Because boy, those big corporations need a lot of help. Yeah, to understand what they're doing. So somewhere to walk out of here some point to know what, where am I?
And that's a very good point. There's no sense in us demonizing others, you know, as the cause of all this. We're all, and that's sort of what I started out with, we're all in bondage to this. We're all a part of it. We're complicit with us with it. And I would suggest that we'll never make our way out of this grand and dangerous mess alone. We will have to think about extremely radical lifestyle changes, how we buy, how we invest, how we transport ourselves, but we also need to think in community about community action and how we will work together as communities in small and local ways and global ways. How will we work with international communities? How will we link up with people in our own town, in our own neighborhood, and on the global scene to forge these other paths? I love the movements towards lifestyle changes, but I also think it's important that we remember that that's not our only calling towards lifestyle changes.
How much of the wealth of our nation is in it? What percent of the people now? It's shrinking in percent. Yeah. I mean, fewer and fewer yes. of the very wealthy.
Yes. Well,
and the dollar amounts to them is much more.
Right.
In masses now.
Your point is well taken, and in light of that and the point that was in the back, there are a number of organizations, just people's organizations, very credible with very knowledgeable people that are looking at these dynamics. And one that is looking at that gap in the United States is called United for a Fair Economy. And I have materials from them here, and I'll leave them up here for people who want to take a look. They're based in Boston, and you could really just call the information in Boston for United for a Fair Economy, and they're doing good teaching and training and ideas about changes. There were two hands. There was Karen and then Paul.
Yeah, I'm not very particular about this, but if you think of the God that we serve as the Holy Trinity, and the Holy Trinity is it's a complex God of three persons who interrelate to each other continuously in love, then our God is a model of the way that we should also live in an interconnected, loving way with all people, and not just other Christians, because all people are made in God's image. And so that is another model for another way to think of community, as well as the web of life, to also think of God as the Holy Trinity as our model to relate. Cool.
It is, and it's fascinating to think how that theological notion of a interrelationship of love that is constitutive of God's self, a God who is ontologically, by his, her very being, a relationship of love, how interesting it is to think that that is consistent with what the new physics is also finding, that there is an interrelationship of all life woven together, or the new cosmologies that are finding out that maybe Earth is an organic being itself. So I think it's fascinating the way you hold up the beautiful Trinitarian notion of a dance of life between the three persons of God is consonant with what some other sources of human knowledge are also finding. That notion is so beautiful, and it is such a thing to hold up in imaging who we are. Some of the early theologians, the great Cappadocians, early Greek theologians, used a word for the relationship between the three figures of the Trinity that really is related to our word choreography, meaning a choreographed kind of dance that is going on in the very being of God. That can help to shape our different understanding of who we are. Not an autonomous individual seeking one's own economic gain.
Individual Christians are not individual.
No.
Definition, they are persons in relationship.
Well, and in Luther's terms, mystical as they are, Christians become a communion of love. In the sacrament, become, quote unquote, a communion of love. A communion of love is far from an autonomous individual looking just for economic gain. One more question and then we need to close. Paul.
This is kind of a personal question and you can avoid it if you want to.
Yeah. Thank you.
In Seattle, would you have been among the protesters?
Was I among the protesters?
Were you?
Yes, with carefully chosen. I was aligned with carefully chosen sectors of the protesters, yes. With the church, with the churches.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. It was actually a fascinating part of the protest because it was where church people from many different denominations were together, and it was a part led by indigenous people from around the globe who were there around certain things, especially related to the seeds and the use of indigenous knowledge. So it was a very powerful place to be, and the talk was given by Christian and Jewish, and I think other religious leaders in Seattle.
And wasn't labor a part of that segment?
Yeah, labor was also a part of that segment.
Which is a very interesting alliance that labor and the faith communities came together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just quickly pull us back to where we are. And really, thank you all for the insightful comments and questions. My point, my overall point in this is this. The form of globalization underway today is enabled by a set of beliefs that kind of serve as a theology. They include beliefs about human freedom and human being. If that form of globalization is dangerous to life on earth today, then those underlying beliefs must be seen and uncovered and questioned. More than that, alternative notions of human being and human freedom are to be located and lived. I would suggest that our faith traditions offer those alternatives. Luther, in fact, is a rich source of powerful beliefs about human being and freedom. Tomorrow, we journey into the terrain of Martin Luther, looking for those alternatives and their power to encourage us in seeking lives of justice and compassion and ecological sustainability. So that's where we're going, and thanks for being part of the journey.
Thank you.
Yeah.